From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. American universities are supposed to be the great ladder up, but colleges benefit in rankings and cash from enrolling high-scoring, high-affluence students. There's a real tension there. It can work against the poor and middle class right on the ladder that should take them up. This hour On Point, class and college. In the USA Now, you can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see a predominance of the affluent on your campus? How do we keep the doors of opportunity open to all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Riverdale, New York, is Catherine Hill, president of Vassar College. Last week, Vassar was awarded a $1 million prize, the Cook Prize for Equity in Educational Excellence, for their efforts to enroll and graduate lower-income students. President Hill, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on.
Congratulations to you, first of all, for winning this award. You're also an economist who has studied this for a long time. What's happening? We American universities, we always think of as the place, I mean, we know if you go far enough back in history, yes, they were bastions of the well-to-do. But in the 20th century, the reputation was as a big mixing barrel for this country. Is that still the case in the way that it was?
I think there's been an increasing emphasis on looking at socioeconomic diversity in our schools and a push on the part of the private nonprofits to do more, although I think the recession in 08-09 put us back a little bit. I do think one of the major challenges is what's happening in the publics, where we're seeing a cutback in state support, because that's been the place where there's been real ability for lower and middle income students to get an education and move up.
So why is the Cook Foundation coming in here and feeling the necessity to give a prize to schools who do well by lower and middle income students?
Because I think they wanted to recognize schools that are doing a good job at it, and I think Vassar is a school that has been committed to this and is really doing some good things. And I think they would like to encourage more schools to do more.
I want to talk about what Vassar's done to try and keep on top of this. As a president here, and you were provost before at Williams College, what are the dynamics that work against universities keeping good diversity in their income backgrounds of their students?
Well, I think the challenge is that any resources that you allocate to need-based financial aid are resources that you don't have to spend on other things. So you're always making trade-offs on the margin about what's going to add most to your educational mission. And I think on top of that, increasing income inequality in the United States is making this more challenging for schools right now, because the gaps between the wealthy and the lower and middle income students has increased significantly over the last 40 years, and that creates additional challenges for us.
Meaning if you don't go to the affluent applicant or entrant, then you've got to be ready to subsidize the lower income.
That's right. And with increasing income inequality, a couple of things are working against you. The higher income kids are having huge resources invested in them, from prenatal care through graduating from high school. So they look like very talented and attractive candidates. And their families are willing to pay the full tuition and, in fact, want a lot of the services that are associated with that. So it puts some pressure on our costs. And then the lower-income and middle-income families have done less well, and so we're committed to recruiting them, but it means more financial aid resources.
So you have to make a couple of decisions there, I guess, as a college president. One, putting more financial aid money toward those students, and two, does that also mean that you're going to have to open your doors to students whose scores may not be quite as high? Does that turn around and bite you on the rankings competition?
You absolutely don't have to do that. I've done some work with a colleague, Gordon Winston, and others have done work as well to say that there are plenty of talented low-income kids out there. So over the time when we've increased our representation of a socioeconomically diverse student body, our credentials, you know, things like academic achievement, have actually gone up. So absolutely not.
That's great to hear. What about on the financial aid side? Where do you find those dollars that you might be tempted as a college president to put into whatever it is, that new gym or climbing wall or science facility?
Well, we didn't do the climbing wall, so that was one thing.
Okay.
I think you have to look really carefully at everything that you're spending money on and try to figure out where you think, every dollar that we spend, we're spending on something that adds value to what we do. But you have to see what you can reallocate so that you can actually spend these resources on financial aid in a way that you think you create a better learning environment and you're serving your commitment to the mission of economic mobility better. So you have to look right across everything that you're doing.
Who decides at a college like yours, President Hill, whether or not to make this a priority? How much influence can you have as a president alone? Do you have to bring along your trustees? Who sort of decides where the needle is going to sit on prioritizing class diversity in a good school these days?
I think the whole community has to be on board. When we shifted in 07, we had conversations with faculty, with students, with administrators, with our board of trustees, and even with alums. So I think you have to bring the whole community on board so that you've got a commitment to this as part of what you're trying to accomplish as an institution.
Do you find resistance? Do college presidents find resistance among people saying, hey, this is not the most important thing we have to do?
I think college presidents find resistance to just about everything they do from somebody. And sure, different people have different views about the trade-offs. There's usually not unanimity about just about anything. But I think you have to have broad-based discussions and get buy-in to this notion that we're committed to this notion of socioeconomic diversity and mobility.
Vassar, your school just walking off with $1 million prize, this Cook Prize for Equity and Educational Excellence for doing fairly well at that. And we congratulate you on that, President Catherine Hill at Vassar. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
With me now from Washington, Richard Rick Collenberg. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, writes about education, labor, civil rights. Rick, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Steve Bird, senior policy analyst with the New America's Education Policy Program. Steve, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rick, the problem, what are the dimensions of it here? Do we really have a more affluent college population today than we did, you pick the time frame, 40 years ago?
Yeah, things are getting worse overall. Right now we have rich kids outnumbering poor kids by 14-1 at the 200 most selective colleges and universities in this country. So a huge imbalance. I mean, we've made some important strides on gender, on racial diversity, but socioeconomic diversity remains kind of this challenge out there for the nation. There have been some institutions that have made some progress, and you know, Kathy Hill is a gem. She's done tremendous work at Vassar to try to address this issue. But the reason Vassar won the prize is because they're the outlier. Most universities now are fine with bringing together fairly wealthy kids of all colors and calling that sufficient diversity. For example, at the most selective colleges, 86% of African-American students are middle or upper class, and the white students are even wealthier. So we've got a real skew in this country right now.
When you say 14-1, that's a really arresting ratio. What is that exactly? How do you define the parts of that?
Well, so I'm defining it as if you look at the four socioeconomic quartiles that families are coming from, the richest quartile outnumbers the poorest quartile by about 14-1. So I think it's about 5% of students are coming from the lowest quarter of the population. So they're quite underrepresented. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the wealthiest quarter of the population is overrepresented at the selective colleges.
Steve Bird, how does that compare with how this country did when it was doing its best on mixing classes in university, top universities?
I mean, I agree with Rick that things have definitely gotten worse. I mean, there was a time when colleges were, you know, fully bastions of privilege with, mostly students from the upper middle classes.
Go back a century and there you
upper
are.
Upper classes, yeah. But then in the 60s and 70s, there was a real push from the federal government to bring in low-income students to campuses and minority students, and there were some big advances. And unfortunately, in recent years, it seems like we're going back into the opposite direction.
I mean, do you know how much sliding there's been on that? If it's 14 to 1 today, is there a comparable ratio or number for 1978 or you name it?
I don't have a number for that, but I think what's really worrisome, and Kathy Hill mentioned this, is on the public higher education side of the equation, where we're seeing, you know, there have been in recent years huge cutbacks in funding, and these public colleges are more and more looking to higher income out of state students and international students to make up for lost revenue.
Which comes out, presumably, of their capacity to enroll lower-income students in their own state. They want students who can come and pay full freight.
Absolutely.
Is it possible, Rick, that our colleges, if we're not careful, turn from, you know, mixing classes, getting them together, providing a lot of opportunity, into institutions that actually cement advantage of those already affluent when they start?
Yes. Well, that's precisely what's happening today. If you look at what's, you know, kind of more broadly at not only the selective colleges, but the community colleges, the less selective four-year institutions, we're seeing this growing divide. The Century Foundation put together a task force not long ago that found that at community colleges, our two-year sector, we're seeing increasing levels of poverty. So we're now seeing a divided, bifurcated system, with rich kids going to selective four-year institutions, low-income students increasingly at community colleges, and unfortunately we know that on average the community colleges are not providing the same resources and opportunities for students.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American colleges leaning toward the affluent, leaving behind the middle class and poor, and the push to turn that around. Richard Kallenberg joins us from the Century Foundation in Washington, D.C. Steve Bird is with us from the New American Foundation. They both looked at this extensively. Of course, everyone talks about the price of that higher education and the kind of crisis it has helped create, student debt and more. Here's President Obama, University of Buffalo, 2013.
Bottom line is this. We've got a crisis in terms of college affordability and student debt. And over the past 4 years, what we've tried to do is to take some steps to make college more affordable.
It's not easy. Here's the University of Pennsylvania president, Amy Gutman, talking on MSNBC's Morning Joe about colleges needing to do better to expand opportunity for all students.
We, as universities and colleges, have to make ourselves affordable with financial aid and by graduating the vast majority of our students.
And if you are one of those who gets in, you may find yourself a little bit fish out of water. Here's Stanley Stewart, a junior at Brown and the first in his family to attend college, telling the New York Times it can be hard for him to fit in.
For me personally, making friends at Brown was a little bit difficult just because I had never been surrounded by people who were this rich in my entire life.
Rick, Steve, here's Alex responding to us online and seeing this as, all right, you've got elite institutions who have higher income families and having the sense that, well, what do you expect? Alex writes to us on Facebook, elite colleges are not public education. If you want better, pay more. It's like saying, how can we get more people that can't afford mansions into mansions? What do you say, Steve?
Well, I mean, I think that students from all walks of life should have the opportunity to go to the best colleges in the country. And I don't think that they should be closed off just because they're elite.
We had the impression, Rick, that it was actually some of the best colleges in the country or the most prestigious that were actually the easiest for low-income students to afford because they had supposedly these great financial aid packages. Is that not true, Rick?
Well, the very top universities do have substantial aid packages, but the problem is they first have to admit students. So it's very easy to have a generous program of financial aid if you only admit 10% of your students from low-income backgrounds, as many of these institutions do. Let me also say, in response to to the email you received, mm-hmm. there's this idea that private institutions, the wealthy institutions, are not supported by the public, so they can kind of do whatever they want. There was a fascinating study that just came out from Mark Schneider at the American Institute for Research, which found that the per capita subsidy, the public subsidy at Princeton University, is on the order of $100,000 per pupil. Now, it's not that the federal government or the state governments are giving direct aid to Princeton, but rather that because Princeton sits on this enormous endowment that is not taxed, that their, you know, their real estate is not taxed, the gains mm-hmm. in their, you know, the capital gains and dividends are not taxed, that that tax subsidy is the equivalent of $100,000 per pupil. And the rationale for that is that Princeton is a nonprofit institution that is serving the public interest. Well, when so few students from modest means have access to a place like Princeton, I don't think they're serving the public interest. There are, you know, talent runs throughout our society, and we're wasting a lot of the talents of low-income and working-class students who could do quite well if given the opportunity, but are now largely shut out from selective colleges and universities.
And, of course, there's the sense, acute sense of opportunity and fairness here. Selective colleges now, each of the last four presidents graduate therefrom, all nine current Supreme Court justices. So who's going to have access to that kind of station in our society?
I was just going to say that, you know, there's one study that found that half of government leaders and half of business leaders come from just 12 very wealthy institutions of higher education. So it matters who goes to these selective colleges, because our leadership class disproportionately derives from those colleges. And it would be better, in my view, I think society would be better off if we had more students who knew what it was like to struggle financially before they reached their position of leadership. So I'm just echoing your point.
Let me bring our callers in. Dan in Cleveland, Ohio. Dan, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
Yeah, so I'm a current student right now. I'm going to a state school in Northeast Ohio.
Okay.
I grew up in Lorain County, a home of Oberlin College, probably one of the most selective and most expensive institutions out there. Coming out of high school, I was enrolled to go to a small liberal arts college, kind of similar to an Oberlin here in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, actually pivoted and deferred my enrollment, and now I'm attending a state school, and I really do love it. I'm getting a great education. I'm in a really good program.
Good.
But our tuition going up 10% next year. It's already $7,000 a semester. And something that I see, I don't see wealthy students dominating the college campus, but I do see a huge, huge, just in the last 20 years, you know, we've quadrupled the amount of administrators we've had. Our capital costs have gone way up, which in turn, our tuition goes way up. And I'm in a city right now where one in two youth are below the poverty line. $7,000 a semester is not something that is affordable, and that's going to continue to go up. And meanwhile, our faculty have seen their pay decrease, because now three-quarters of our faculty are adjuncts because of just how the books are balanced, it seems. And they have to, you know, moonlight at the community colleges, and the quality of instruction here at our state schools is definitely degrading due to all these financial factors.
So, Dan, do you feel the system overall is treating you fairly?
I'm come from a place of privilege. You know, I'm okay. I do have family that supports me, and my tuition costs are covered. But from some of my friends, you know, my fiance, she's from that bottom quartile you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
She cannot go to school. She can't take out the debt, can't afford to go to school, and it's crushing. You know, we've had a lot of tearful nights talking about this. She wants opportunity, and it's really crushing, and it's something that we're doing to our youth right now and today. So that's my two cents. That's my perspective on this.
Dan in Cleveland, I appreciate your call very much. Steve Bird, what do you make of this story?
Well, I mean, it really does show that opportunity at public colleges is going down. And I think that, you know, we tend to think of only the elite institutions as being the ones where that are becoming bastions of privilege. And I think that we really should worry about what's going on with public higher education in this country.
Why should it be so? The United States gained a lot of advantage by having the highest, the best college-educated population in the world for a long time. Isn't it still clear that that would be advantageous?
I mean, yeah, it's definitely clear to me, but and to lots of policymakers as well. But you know, we've seen states disinvesting. A lot of this has come down to states not wanting to increase taxes. In fact, cutting taxes, and then there are also other programs like Medicare and Medicaid that states have to find money for. And so higher ed has become kind of an easy place for them not to invest because they could always raise tuition.
Rick, if we could do it right before, why not now? Does it all go back to Medicaid and Medicare and pension costs, or is there a change in priorities?
I think it's a change in priorities. I mean, you raise an excellent point that, you know, we used to beat other countries economically because we tapped into the talents of all people. Not perfectly, obviously. There were groups who were marginalized, but Claudia Golden has this book that suggests because we were early in tapping into the talents of women, a real leader in that area, that accelerated the U.S. economy tremendously. And right now we're missing out on all of the talents of low-income and working-class students who have a lot to contribute, but are not included in this in higher education. I mean,
But many are in higher education.
But it matters where you go. What we do is we provide access to community colleges for low-income and working-class students, and then educate them on the cheap. We invest much less in our community college sector than we do in the four-year.
And I'm reading here something like 80% of them intend to go on and get four-year degrees, but only 10 or 15% actually do.
Yes, yes. And so there's a lot of enormous amount of inefficiency. Because we don't invest, we end up not being able to support students. And so we have these dismal completion rates at the community college sector.
Another place where low-income students are going are for-profit colleges, and we've seen, you know, lots of stories and investigations about how for-profits treat their students.
Not delivering on some of the educational promises that are made there. Let me go to Chicago and Abhi. Abhi, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. What's your story?
So I actually go to a state school in the city of Chicago,
okay.
Born and raised in the state, and it has come to the situation where, and this is from me, I was student body president in the past and really had to take a look at, you know, peer institutions and what's going on in the country, and from what I kept seeing, it was that like you've been saying, the private elite universities were more and more taking on the wealthy students, and the impetus to cater to the low-income students was put as a burden on the public schools, especially in urban environments. And we've seen this trend where right now we only have a 54% six-year graduation rate nationally. I come from a school that's just barely more than that. We're at 56%. And the question becomes, in a state like Illinois, where our governor has said that he wants to propose a 31% budget cut for higher education, on top of what has been two decades of disinvestment, the question becomes, can the publics, which have been tasked with catering to these students, even provide the services in order to graduate students, or are we furthering the cycle by getting students debt and then not giving them a degree or the education needed at the end of the day?
Debt and out the door without a diploma. Abhi, I appreciate your call from Chicago. Steve, how about it? If you see the education of lower-income students as a burden, is this shift to more affluent student populations among elite schools shifting that burden to public institutions?
I think that low-income and middle-class students have gone to public schools for, you know, a while. I think that public higher education has really, as you said, been a conveyor belt to the middle class. And again, state disinvestment is really leading to these kind of situations. And the worst thing that can happen to people is to have large debt and not graduate.
But, Rick, you hear our smart student from Chicago, student body president there at a state school, feeling as though there's a kind of extra burden being put on state universities, even as their student bodies maybe lower income or a greater concentration there. And then they don't have the resources, they don't graduate, they've got debt, no diploma, and we're actually producing the opposite dynamic than the conveyor belt ladder that we all associate with university education.
Well, that's right. I mean, what we do is shower the greatest resources on the students who are already the most advantaged, and then provide fewer supports and resources for the students who need it most. I mean, at the K through 12 level, there's long been the principle in place that states are going to allocate extra resources to schools that have higher concentrations of poverty. And that's what the federal government Title I program does as well. It's implemented imperfectly, but at least the principle's there. In higher education, we do precisely the opposite. You know, we put the most resources into those institutions that are educating the most advantaged students. And then we're surprised somehow when there are these very low graduation rates, students take on debt and end up not being able to complete. And it's getting worse. I mean, in the community college sector, for example, it used to be that the richest quarter of the population had roughly proportional representation. This was in the 1980s. That's declined. So fewer and fewer wealthier students are attending community colleges, more and more low-income and working-class students, and that creates a negative political environment where when you go to the state legislature for funds, there are very few people with political power who can make the case on behalf of funding our community college sector, you know, which is educating almost half of our higher education students, and yet not seeing the results that we want.
Because they're not thinking, hey, that's my child in there. It's not their it's somebody else's child, someone poorer's child in there.
Absolutely. I mean, so, you know, we've known since Brown versus Board of Education that separate is not equal, whether it's racially separate or economically separate. And yet that's increasingly what we have in higher education, a system of separate and unequal.
Steve, do you see that dynamic here, not just the demands of other public programs that people want, but a kind of turning away of the powerful from the institutions that should be the leg-up institutions?
I mean, I agree completely with Rick. When you look at even where you look at where states are putting their most money, they're putting them into the flagship institutions, and community colleges end up getting, sort of the scraps that are left over. And again, they are the ones who are really the workhorses here. Again, this is very worrisome.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American colleges leaning toward the affluent and the push to turn that around. Stephen Bird is with us from the New America Foundation in Washington. Rick Kallenberg from the Century Foundation there as well. We're going to go to Washington University in St. Louis in just a moment here. Interesting comments online. Rick, Steve, Belinda writes to us, "It was hard enough for me to fit in at a state school. If it's that hard to wear Kmart clothes in an Abercrombie environment, how much harder would it be to wear Kmart clothes in at an elite school? No, thank you," she writes. Elizabeth writes to us on Facebook, "At my niece's college, a large number of the elites are coming from China. Their parents own businesses, and these kids drive Mercedes, BMW, Lamborghinis." True, she puts in parentheses, "trying to keep up with this crowd. It's horrible." Well, there you've got global wealth concentrated on some American campuses. Dave in Rutland, Vermont. Dave, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
Great show and a very timely topic. As the father of a high school senior, I just finished going through this process, and we applied to a lot of the elite schools that you're talking about,
okay,
in the Northeast, mm-hmm, and they all advertised that they were admissions, needs-blind admissions, meaning, you know, you were accepted not based on your ability or inability to pay. But from what your guests are talking about, that doesn't sound like that's the case. It sounds like they all take family income in account in their admissions process. I'd love to get there. Comments on that.
Well, that's interesting. Dave, I'm glad you raise it. Steve Bird, how about it? If it's need blind, and we do hear this advertised, but how widely is that advertised and practiced? And if it's practiced, how do you end up with the kind of skewed demographics that we're talking about, Steve?
Well, there are a couple of issues around need blind. I mean, in practice, the schools that say they are need blind don't take income into account in their admissions decisions. However, the stuff that they value, like extracurricular activities that maybe low-income students aren't able to engage in because they're working full-time, the stuff that they value really is much more for upper-middle-class students and higher-income students. And the other issue is when a school is need blind, I do question whether they actually are blind to that need. They don't take income into account, but they know where the students come from. You know, they know where the students live. They read students' essays that may give them a good indication of students' background. So I don't know that need blind is really a perfect system.
Let me go to St. Louis, Missouri, and Holden Thorpe. Holden Thorpe is provost and executive vice chancellor for academic affairs at Washington University in St. Louis. He was previously chancellor of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Washington University, I'm reading here from a recent report, says held the dubious distinction of being the least socioeconomically diverse college in the country, though the report is that that's about to change. Holden Thorpe, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
What were the dynamics that went into Wash U becoming the least socioeconomically diverse college in the country? How'd that happen?
Well, I think you've heard a lot of that over the course of this hour. We made a lot of investments to move Washington University from really not being a player in terms of the national higher education world to being a really prestigious university that a lot of people want to come to. Those decisions were made long before I got here,
mm-hmm,
but in recent years, and especially the last year, and since what I've been working on since I've gotten here, is to do what we need to do and should do to make Washington University accessible to everybody who deserves a chance to be here, and that's why we've announced that we're going to double the number of students that we have here that are eligible for Pell Grants. And you know, that's the beginning of a transformation where Washington University will step up to the obligations that all great American research universities have to make sure everybody who deserves a chance to be here can come here and be successful.
Explain, if you would, Holden Thorpe, how this works. You've got an inside track on seeing this. So you've got a university, Washington University. You want it to have higher status. You want it to be better. In the process of making it better, it becomes more exclusive and more affluent. Why do those flow together?
Well, because part of it is, a big part of it is that You have to make a lot of investments to attract faculty and build facilities and build your research programs to make them more competitive, and that takes money away from what could have gone into financial aid. That's the biggest factor, but you've also heard that there are a lot of college students who are really attractive and lots of schools are trying to recruit them who are from wealthy backgrounds, and you know, as they apply to your school in greater numbers, it's you know, it's good for the school in many ways to admit more of those. So when you put those two things together, that's kind of how we got here. But we're about the business of taking the next step now and opening this place up to more people, and that's exciting. And I think it's really energized people here that we're doing this.
It is exciting. How did you come to that consensus? Was it the uncomfortable position in the spotlight as the least socioeconomically diverse? Was it did you bring in new people? Was it your own view? Who had to be persuaded to take this turn, Mr. Thorpe?
Well, when I was interviewing to come here, it was something that we talked about. That was before the intense scrutiny of this started. But there's no doubt that the attention that we've gotten has helped us build consensus for this. I heard the president of Vassar a few minutes ago saying, you know, you've got to get everybody on board if you want to do this. And having this great national conversation about college access has really helped us build consensus to do this among our board and the people who work here and the students and faculty. And, you know, we're in this moment where every day you see another book about higher education coming out. I mean, Frank Bruni's got a book, and Fareed Zakaria's got a book, and
yep.
A lot of higher ed pundits have books. And so, you know, I think we're in this moment now, the last, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, where people are really focused on these questions, and that has helped us galvanize folks to make these steps for WashU, and we're real excited to do it.
Did you face similar issues when you were in the public university system in North Carolina?
Definitely not the same kinds. Carolina is a place that, you know, among the schools with really high graduation rates, probably does about the best. 21% of the students are Pell eligible, but that's a different deal because at North Carolina, the in-state tuition is $8,000 and the Pell Grant's $5,700. At WashU, the tuition's $45,000 and the Pell Grant's $5,700. So it's a bigger financial commitment that the private universities have to make in order to do this. But, you know, sadly and unfortunately, this hasn't happened at North Carolina yet, but as has also been said on this program, the public universities are becoming a lot less accessible, both in terms of the out-of-pocket costs for low-income students, even if they're in-state, and also because it's easier to succeed in many ways if you're a higher-income student at public universities. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, if you just look at who gets into medical school and who gets a Rhodes Scholarship and who does a lot of the things that universities put the spotlight on, even at public universities, that tends to be students from wealthier backgrounds, and that's something that we desperately need to address, both public and private.
How do you analyze that? Is that because they've had better preparation before they show up? Is that because they live in a milieu when they're not on campus that somehow has them more aligned with success in those other arenas?
Well, Kathy Hill said this when she was on, and I want to emphasize that she was absolutely right that the low-income students that we're talking about going to Vassar and WashU, those are students who have scores that are just as good as the students who are paying the full freight. But I think that we have a lot of barriers in higher education related to how we teach science and who succeeds in science classes. And as you just said, not everybody has the same flexibility to do all the different things in college that some students do. And that's something that we have to really pay attention to. So we think of it as three parts. One is giving good packages to the low-income students that we admit in terms of aid. We've been doing well on that. The second is admitting more low-income students, and we're getting ready to do that. And then the third is making sure that they feel welcome and can succeed when they're here. And, you know, we're standing up a lot of different projects to make sure that we get that done, too.
Holden Thorpe, please stand by in St. Louis. Carl is calling from New Orleans. Carl, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. You know the reason why the tuition at these colleges are so high?
Simple as that. Well, Holden Thorpe, why is it so darn high?
Well, there are a lot of different stakeholders in universities who all want different things from us. And we continue to try to do new and exciting things in research and with information technology. And we have more and more regulations that come from the people who give us money and the people who watch and make sure that we do things related to our nonprofit status correctly and international regulations. And we're struggling to do that, all those things as efficiently as possible, while meeting the very high expectations that students have and their families have and the local politicians have, and everybody looks at universities, wants something different from us, and we need to get better at refocusing our efforts on research and teaching and trying to get out of as many of the extraneous things that we sometimes end up doing as we can.
Jackie in Providence, Rhode Island. Jackie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, I am a university professor and have been for many, many years now. And I agree somewhat with your previous caller, and yet I have to respectfully disagree in many areas, in the sense that from what I've seen, it isn't faculty that are the reason for these tuitions going up, because faculty are not better paid than they have been in the past, you know, beyond cost of living increases. To me, what I see the problem stemming from, and again, it's sort of goes along with his third point there, is administration. Our university, the one that I'm teaching at right now, is so administration top-heavy. It's unbelievable. And these people are making over $250,000 a year, and the administration is hired to bring in students. So ultimately, the problem of education getting higher and it benefiting the wealthy students is systemic. It's because they're paying... They have to pay administrators whose job it is to go out and bring students to the university. And, of course, they're not bringing in the students who need scholarships. They need to bring in students who are wealthy or who can afford to pay.
Jackie, let us pick it up right there, if you'll permit me. Steve Byrd, what about it? You know, you could imagine institutions being taken captive, I suppose, by highly paid administrators, maybe large in number, and then they have a built-in interest in not having financial aid students.
Well, I'm not sure it's as direct as that. I do think that there is a big question about administrative bloat and how much that is leading to higher tuitions and higher costs. I think that, you know, in general, the institutions do look to higher income students to build their revenues and build their prestige.
Let me go to Orson in Boston. Orson, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Great call. I'll first say that I'm African-American, and I actually graduated from Vassar about 30 years ago.
Okay.
And one of the things that I find really disturbing is the way that you're using there's this use of low-income, middle-class, and working-class interchangeably. And, it you know, there's a big difference between all three of those, and you know, even to be middle class in America, you know, most people cannot afford a $70,000 a year tuition. And as such, what happens is some of those very middle class people who you're talking about bringing into this, you know, an elite college structure are actually themselves privileged. Even just because they can't afford $70,000 doesn't mean they're necessarily poor. And the point that I would like to make is that, you know, economic diversity, and we have to always remember this, does not equal ethnic diversity.
That's for sure.
And particularly among ethnic diversity when it comes to traditionally excluded groups. And I think what's one of the things that I'm finding a little frightening is that we've gone into this conversation of making college affordable for the middle class, but a lot can get lost in that translation.
Well, are you saying that
we need to accept the big presence of the affluent in order to sustain racial diversity, Orson?
Oh, no. I don't think that at all.
I mean, surely there's plenty of folks of all racial and ethnic backgrounds at all, certainly at low-income levels in this country, and a step or two above as well, wouldn't there be?
I don't really understand your question.
I mean, can't we we have to lose something in terms of ethnic or racial diversity if we go for socioeconomic diversity?
No, we don't necessarily have to lose it, but we actually have to be conscious of both. And so for example, I actually found that, so, you know, of myself and my friends who were able to get into those types of schools back in the 70s,
yeah,
when we did have a lot of federal programs, federal dollars that helped us get in there, I saw a trend in the, like, particularly beginning in the 80s and 90s, where a lot of those schools became less diverse. And what you have is, you know, now schools count whether they have a HANA and a LANA quotients, where they're lumping in African-American, Latino, and foreign students, including some of the Chinese students that one of your callers talked about, who have themselves affluent, as their metric of diversity. And I'm just saying that, you know, the diversity quotient is not even so much for the students who are of those backgrounds.
Orson, we've got it. Watch what you gain and what you might lose. Holden Thorpe at Washington University in St. Louis, thank you very much and good luck to you there. Steve Bird in Washington, Rick Kallenberg in Washington, thank you to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.